everyone. My name is Matthew Holt, and I'm part of the JPM Biotech Equity Research Team. It's my pleasure to introduce our next presenting company, Ultragenyx Pharmaceuticals. Presenting for Ultragenyx today will be the CEO and President, Emil Kakkis. And please note that following the presentation, it's actually at 1:30, there will be a breakout session in the Olympic Room, which is to the left. So with that, I'll hand it over to you.
Thanks very much, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm happy to be here to give you an update on Ultragenyx. This is our legal warning. Company now, I think 2020, just coming close to 10 years from founding, is really positioned for significant value growth. We have strong revenue drivers with the Crysvita franchise, which is growing at an exceptional rate, in addition to other products. In fact, expect to have three products and four indications approved later this year. With that, we have a diverse portfolio of early-stage clinical pipeline and current clinical pipeline, including gene therapy programs, generating data and generating value for us. And finally, our financial strength is in a very good place, with greater than $750 million in cash, and starting to turn the corner on burn with our significant 20% or greater decrease in our net cash burn for the year. So from a standpoint of revenue, portfolio, and cash and finances, I think we're in a tremendous position as a company 10 years after founding. If you look at the company in more detail, we've crossed $100 million in revenue this year. In 2019, that was an important step in any company, and we've done it relatively quickly from a standing start in 2010. Two products going to four later in the year, two commercial programs, multiple others on deck for IND filings, and a  25,000 patient population. By 2025, we expect to approach $1 billion in revenue, 7+ programs that are commercial, five clinical programs, maybe 150,000 patients potentially treatable. We expect to have more manufacturing base, including a commercial gene therapy plant, in addition to the quality plant we have already put together, in addition to their network of CMOs that do our work for manufacturing. So we're a company on our way to becoming that larger and perhaps one of the most exceptional rare disease companies. If you dive into the revenue growth, particularly, Crysvita is forming the major base of that, but with Mepsevii and our next 007 program, in addition to the TIO indication, we expect that to be a foundational growth of revenue going forward, heading toward $1 billion, and we'll expect the additional assets, including the FOD product and some of the gene therapies and others, to start adding to that growth in revenue. And we expect something like a 10x revenue growth in the next 5 years. So we're a company on that trajectory, at that inflection point of becoming a commercial and profitable company. Now, we put out our preliminary revenue for 2019 was $86 million-$88 million for Crysvita, including the European royalty, and then total company revenue, as I said, crossing $100 million. If you look at Crysvita for the coming 2020, we put out guidance for the first time. With a couple of years of experience now in the marketplace, we're able to push out what we think are the numbers expected for the year and around $125 million-$140 million, which is substantial growth from where we were before, and we'll talk more about Crysvita launch dynamics in a few moments. Our cash position, I said, greater than $750 million. We did a $320 million royalty, capped royalty financing. I think this deal allowed us to gain value from the royalty stream coming from Europe, which was primarily driven off our partner's work, but allowed us then to finance without diluting the company and put us in good position from a cash position going forward, with enough cash runway to take us to 2023. When you combine that with the fiscal discipline we are applying, which is to reduce cash burn with a 20+% decrease in cash burn, it puts us in very good position of turning the corner financially as a company, and we're excited about how that puts us in position then to drive the pipeline. Now, the pipeline shown here, the top three bars that are green are products either approved or going to be approved. TIO indication is coming, and it's been filed, as we announced. The LC-FAOD program is filed, and those two should be moved over to approved by the end of the year. The clinical pipeline is right now dominated by the two main gene therapy programs that we're running, but also there's a hemophilia program that our partner, Bayer, is running. In addition to that base of clinical pipeline, we have two much larger indications, the Wilson gene therapy and the Angelman program, both form product opportunities that are more on the par of Crysvita in terms of their potential and would help establish a broader base and a larger upside potential for the company going forward. And that is our plan in general, to have a mixed risk return, smaller niche products that we can get, they're not competitive, that can allow us to get grow our revenue base, but we also will look for larger opportunities that can help build and grow value quicker, as the blend of those will give us the best outcome. Here's the clinical catalyst coming from the pipeline. We are expecting now to get, in addition to the OTC data we just put out, we'll expect to get our glycogen storage disease type 1 data this first half. And in addition, the Angelman program will enter the clinic in the first half of the year. By the second half, we would expect our review of LCFFD to be completed, and PDUFA date is in July. With that, we also expect more data on DTX301 from the steroid cohort we'll talk about in a moment. In addition, we'll get we'd expect additional data heading toward phase 3 in DTX401, the other gene therapy program. So it's going to be a busy year, a very important catalyst, both gene therapy and other products and regulatory approvals, and we think tremendous value creation opportunity coming in this year. So let me dive deeper in the commercial programs and talk about where we're going in Crysvita, which is the main driver of our revenue. On the left, you can see in the blue bars, you can see the Q4 the tentative numbers, about $30 million in the quarter, a little bit of a step up from Q3 because of a small lumpiness in the shipment, but we can see Crysvita on track with the continuous growth in revenue. To put it in perspective, we put worldwide net sales for Crysvita on the right panel in purple. Those are the purple bars. And we've mapped top 10 rare disease launches first 6 quarters, only excluding Spinraza is the only one which is much higher. But I just put in perspective that Crysvita's launch is on par with the top rare disease launches ever. So I be clear of, as a company first launching, we've done an exceptional job. And I point out to you that the pricing of Crysvita is probably half the pricing of the other products in that pool, which means with a smaller product price but better penetration, we're actually achieving happy patients, happy payers, and a good company outcome. And I think that's very important as we think through hard about what we do in the rare disease model and sustainability. There are ways to do this, and we're being very successful doing it in Crysvita. Now, two more launches coming. We expect the tumor-induced osmolation. We just had our discussion with the FDA and agree on a supplemental BLA content and detail. It was filed in December, which is ahead of plan, and we'd expect to hear back in February about priority review status and the PDUFA date. For UX07 for FEOD, that PDUFA date's in July. We expect that program, like a lot of inborn error products, to build slowly and steadily. We know there's a lot of interest. We are getting a lot of named patient sales already from France in response to their requests, with more than 30 doctors in France, for example. We think there's a lot of interest in this product. There's a lot of FEOD patients that are not doing well. So we expect there to be interest in the product, but it will take time to build, and around 8,000 to 14,000 patients developed world, and we own the product worldwide. So those are our two commercial programs adding to the Crysvita and Mepsevii story. Let's talk about gene therapy, and we put out some data recently in gene therapy, which is part of the basis for our rise in stock price in the last week. Importantly, DTX301 is an AAV8 for OTC, ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency. It's a defect in the urea cycle. The urea cycle is a way for your body to detoxify ammonia. The ammonia gets produced in your body, and you have to detoxify it by making urea. That process is harmed in these patients, doesn't work effectively. The high ammonia levels leads to significant neurological problems, including potential coma, hospitalizations, and death. Currently, there's treatment with transplants or using scavenger drugs. They're incomplete, and there's a lot of room for improvement and something that could be potentially curative. The program data we put out, and this is from data from a phase 1-2 study in 3 cohorts of patients, and we announced cohort 3 data, and I'll tell you a little more about the total set of data. But the most recent data in cohort 3 show we were getting responses really from all 3 patients, and this means that higher dose is working better than the lower or middle doses, and consistent with our belief that we needed to get to a higher dose in order to achieve the adequate level of therapeutic effect. We had another responder come out of the phase cohort 2. They responded a little bit later in the plan, but also with a significant benefit. Of all the patients so far who have gone enough time. We have three complete responders. That is, they were able to get off all their drugs, all their diet, and are doing well. And that, to me, is equivalent to a metabolic cure. And two of those patients now have been on treatment a couple years. So this is a summary, then, of the three cohorts, cohort 1, cohort 2, cohort 3. Cohort 3 is the new data we just put out with the responders and showing a more consistent response down in the cohort 3. Cohort 1 and cohort 2 complete responders are now a couple years out and showing that the durability of their effect and their ability to stay off drugs and diet is continuing. So we feel good about both having a more complete response right now as well as long-term data showing benefit. Now, one of the things we're diving more into is the ammonia story. The FDA has said the ammonia is really important as a clinical endpoint. They consider it a valid clinical endpoint, and they've approved other products for ammonia. So ammonia will play a big role in the clinical trial program. Not all patients have a high ammonia because they may be on drugs and compliant with their diet. In the study, in the last four patients, two of the patients had very elevated ammonias. When you monitor them over a 24-hour period, both of them who had a response showed a sharp and dramatic reduction in their ammonia by 6 weeks, which was sustained during the trial. Among the other patients that started with a normal ammonia, patient 7 went off their drugs by week 6, and they've continued normal in normal ammonias despite removal of their diversion therapy. This is just a consistent part of the story showing that we're changing the metabolic pathway of ammonia in these patients, and we're changing the future of urea cycle patients who have ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency. So safety profile has been excellent, and we're comfortable that the cohort 3 data at 1E13 is an appropriate dose from a safety perspective. They did have mild asymptomatic elevation of transaminases, which were manageable with courses of prednisone. So we're comfortable with the safety profile at E13. So where are we going from here with the OTC gene therapy? We'll enroll three more patients this first half. They'll be using treated with prophylactic steroids. We believe that could enhance the potency and the prevalence of expression and provide potentially more consistent expression. And we want to look at something so simple as that to see if it would optimize the gene therapy. We'll look at that data, and if looks solid and we're impressed, we will then proceed and do another three patients. While that process of cohorts is going on, we'll be engaging with the regulators and discussing the design of the phase 3 as well as the endpoints. But we are very comfortable with ammonia being part of the story and the history of ammonia and our data we have to date that this is a product that's going to get to phase 3 and we believe will be a life-changing treatment for OTC patients. So let me touch on the glycogen storage seed program. We have not put out new data. We had data out in later last year. Glycogen storage seed type 1A is a defect in the enzyme in your liver that releases glucose to the bloodstream. If you can't release glucose to the bloodstream, you get severe hypoglycemia, which can be lethal. You can die during your sleep if you, for example, go low. It is treated currently by giving patients frequent doses of cornstarch every few hours all day long. And some of the patients in the trials have been doing this for 20, 30 years, starch. Now, you might think, well, that's not hard. But it is hard if you think, if I miss your starch dose, you're going to die. And if you look at the quote from Dr. Weinstein, this is a serious disease, and patients liken it to having a gun to your head all the time. That if you miss your mess, you mess up your starch, you don't wake up, your alarm doesn't wake you up, that you could die or your child would die. And so that stress is an incredibly potent problem for these patients. And even with the starch management, which helps them, they're not normalized. They're not doing well. They're surviving, but they're not doing well. We think this is a very important disease, and we think that the biology of the disease, I think, is well-suited to gene therapy, where a small amount of enzyme, just 3% of enzyme, should be sufficient to reverse the problem and cause their liver to release glucose and achieve glucose independent glucose control. We've put out data on the first two cohorts at 2E12 and 6E12 GC per kilo. All six patients respond. All six patients have responded. And even the low-dose cohort have been weaning off their starch treatment, showing that their livers are actually adequately producing glucose and that the need for cornstarch can be dramatically reduced. In cohort 2, we think we saw a more profound effect. This shows you one of the examples of why we think it's a more profound effect. If you look at the green color in the baseline scan, that green color indicates a high fraction of glycogen storage in the liver. And you can see at 24 weeks after the gene therapy, The color changes to blue because, in fact, the glycogen has been resorbed very evenly across the liver. These data and other data on glucose control and lactate control gave us confidence that the cohort 2 group treated with 6E12 was an adequate dose for effective treatment, and we've enrolled another 3 patients. So this is a summary of that data showing both the liver glycogen results. So we're comfortable that this dose is a good dose. We're doing another 3 patients. One of the things we're looking at, though, is understanding how to test the time to hypoglycemia. The use of starch by these patients can confound that test. The next 3 patients will be tested without starch during that test, which will allow us to see more precisely what their liver can do without any supportive treatment. And then we'll see what the gene therapy does without any starch in the background. We think this will make a cleaner result. And so the next cohort data comes out will be without the starch in the time to hypoglycemia testing. We think that'll allow us to tell more exactly what the liver is doing. And our confidence right now is that this will improve our assessment of what's happening. But our view of everything that's going on in these patients is that they have greatly improved glucose control. They're weaning down their starch requirements, and we think we have a treatment that could change the future for glycogen storage patients. So next steps, we'll confirm this cohort. We'll get that data out this first half with the changes I've just mentioned in the starch regimen. So hopefully your seatbelts are fast and we keep moving along. New gene therapy program coming ahead in Wilson disease. Wilson disease is a much larger disease, maybe 10 times the size of some of the other diseases we're working on. It is a disease of copper metabolism. These patients' livers can't properly metabolize and detoxify copper. It ends up filling up the liver, injuring liver, getting into the bloodstream, getting to the brain, and causing tremendous injury. There are treatments, including chelators, to help bind the copper, but they don't solve the problem of copper metabolism. They help reduce the amount of free copper and the injury it can cause, but this by no means a cure and no means sufficient for treating Wilson disease patients. We have been developing a gene therapy and shown now in the knockout mouse model a very beautiful effect on reducing liver inflammation, reducing serum free copper, reducing liver copper, and improving the loading of copper onto ceruloplasmin, an important part of the biology of Wilson disease. All of these factors tell us that we have the potential with this gene therapy to improve Wilson disease. That program is currently setting up. We're heading to the clinic. We'll be using a 2,000-liter HeLa cell manufacturing process, which will allow us to go commercial and go straight through, and we hope to, of course, maximize our efficiency in developing this program with the experience we've had in the other programs. So I mentioned the HeLa system. The HeLa manufacturing system is the largest scalable mammalian manufacturing system. It involves using HeLa cells, creating a producer cell line from which you can recover AAV virus at large scale. It is more akin to vaccine manufacture, and we think is going to be a very high-quality, reproducible commercial manufacturing for AAV and can produce multiple different types of capsids, not restricted as you might be with baculovirus. We've been successfully doing this. We're doing it in the Wilson program, and it's also already been in the clinic in the Heme A program. The OTC and GSD1 programs are using 293 transfection currently. The GSD1 program will convert to HeLa post-marketing. But the ability with the HeLa system, we think, is to greatly improve the scale and reduce the cost of goods. And I think will be a standard for us going forward on our gene therapy programs. So the HeLa system, we think, has gotten some validation recently because our partner Bayer has put out the first data from the Heme A program, which we partnered with them. And that showed a curative effect in the first 2 patients. This is one of the patients shown here, achieving 17 to 20% of normal and a bleed-free post. The important thing is that this dose, 5E12, is 1/10 the dose used by the BioMarin gene therapy program, 1/10 the dose, achieving curative effect. And no steroids, the patient was treated with no steroids in the first two patients that dose. So the safety profile, we think, was excellent. And we think there is a great potential then for this, the HeLa cell system, to produce high-quality AAV and get highly effective gene therapy results. So we're encouraged to look forward on this program and how it continues to release data this year. Our interest is in, we have milestones and a high single to low double-digit royalties on the Heme A program. The last program I want to talk about is a new program for Angelman. We did a deal last year to partner with Genetics, a company formed by patient groups with very expert parents who basically contracted and developed a treatment for their patients. And that treatment, I think the work that they've done is exceptional. And we partnered with them to move forward on an ASO, an antisense oligonucleotide, to treat Angelman syndrome. Angelman syndrome is a neurologic disease, but it has a diverse set of problems affecting both cognition, speech, seizures, ataxia, sleep. And it's related to a problem in how their neurons function. But the neurons are all present. They don't lose neurons. They just don't function as well. And the potential then is that they can reverse this disease through the use of an antisense oligonucleotide, which I'll explain. So the nature of this disease, we think, makes it one of the better diseases in neurology to treat or to be reversible. There is a phase 1-2 study that's being planned for the antisense oligonucleotide, and I'll explain the mechanism of that drug. But that's expected to start this half with basically titration dosing of pediatric patients, and we're excited to see that work get going. Our Genetics team is running that work, and we have an option to acquire this product, assuming they're successful. The science behind this is simple yet complex. The UBE3A gene is the main gene that's deficient in these patients, but it's deficient because of a deletion, usually, most commonly, in the female copy, the mother's copy. The male or father's copy is turned off. So the idea is, if mother's copy is deleted, can we turn on the father's copy? But it turns out the father's copy is turned off with an antisense regulatory RNA that shuts down the gene. So by adding an antisense oligonucleotide to bind that antisense, that repressive RNA, we turn on the paternal copy of the gene that's already present in those cells. And by doing that, restore production of UBE3A and potentially other genes in the area, which we think is a powerful and very specific way that ASO, we think, could be the best strategy for treating this disease. The data so far we were very impressed with and shown that you can get the induction in a dose-dependent way of UBE3A protein while suppressing the antisense RNA, which is shown on the left. And we've shown, most importantly, in monkeys that you can see induction of UBE3A in the cortex of monkeys with doses in the 3 to 5 milligram range, which are well within the safety profile of the product. So we think they've come up with a very potent and specific antisense oligonucleotide. And we're excited to partner with this group and end up in the clinic soon. So be looking for Angelman. So where are we at as a company? 2010, 2019, we've founded, formed, built the pipeline, went public 2014, 59 employees. At 2020, we're now 750 employees. We've got 2 products approved, 2 more coming. We have revenue crossing 100 million. We have a gene therapy franchise, 2 indications in play and others coming, an Angelman product program, a whole series of other early pipeline. We've become a diversified rare disease company. In addition to that, and part we haven't gone through, is we are innovating how you design trials, how you design endpoints, and we're continually to improve how you even commercialize and how you post-marketing monitor patients, managing the cost structure by shortening the time and the post-marketing costs through various designs in our post-marketing programs, and working the regulators on trying to establish a more efficient model for how drugs get developed. I think that's some of the special things we're doing as a company and why we're an exceptional rare disease company. By 2021, 2025, we expect to get to 10x growth, have $1 billion in revenue, multiple approved products, globally commercialized, gene therapy programs, and other pipeline. I think to be one of probably the most exceptional rare disease companies. So I'm excited about the work, and I want to thank all the employees and all the patients that have helped us get to that point. So Q&A will be after a gap in time at 1:30, because there's some speaking sessions, but 1:30 in the Olympic Room, we'll do Q&A, and happy to answer your questions there. Thank you very much.